You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com.
Listening to The Archaeology Show, episode 13. This is a special episode where Chris Webster goes to the 82nd annual meeting of the Society for American Archaeology in Vancouver, Canada. He sits down with Cinzia Perlingieri and Edward Harris to talk about the Harris Matrix. Now, enjoy the show.
All right, we're here at the Society for American Archaeology Conference 2017 in Vancouver, British Columbia. And I don't have April with me. She was supposed to be at this conference, but she's got other things going on. I'll let April talk about that on the next show. But I have, real quick before we introduce our guest, I have another guest co-host with me today. It's Cinzia Perlingieri, which I spelled your name wrong in the notes, which you're probably noticing here.
But you said it right.
Hello,
yes. Everyone.
And she's the executive director of the Center for Digital Archaeology. And there's a very important reason Cinzia is here, because she helped set up this interview with Dr. Edward Harris. How's it going?
Very good. Thank you very much.
So some of you may know that name, but you may not be associating it with the right thing. So what we're going to talk about is Dr. Harris invented, I don't know if that's the right word, invented the Harris Matrix, which a lot of people use all over the world. So we're going to talk about that and some things that CODA is doing with Dr. Harris at the end of this show. We'll talk about that as well. So first off, Dr. Harris, thanks for joining us, and let's just kick the whole thing off, since we have an audience that might not know much about archaeology or have ever heard of the Harris Matrix. What is the Harris Matrix?
In the very simplest terms, the Harris Matrix allowed archaeologists to see time on archaeological sites.
Okay.
And the sort of simplest analogy, in a way, is that every archaeological site is a time capsule. But in order to see time, you have to look at a diagram. So our lives, until the digital revolution, was ruled by two important diagrams: the clock face on a wristwatch and the Gregorian calendar. And if you look back and imagine that you had life without those two diagrams to see time, to organize time in a sequential manner, your life would be reasonably chaotic. Mm-hmm. And you missed the appointments like I did yesterday because I didn't look at the diagram properly. So. And of course, this is vital because on an archaeological site, you're dealing with the physical evidence, and that has to be translated into a diagrammatic form. Mm-hmm. And before the Harris Matrix, they used cross sections as a sort of icon or paradigm for archaeology and archaeologists. But of course, that's just some physical evidence. Mm-hmm. Like the sun coming up and going down creates a day, a sequential day, but that doesn't appear in the calendar.
Right.
It's translated into a diagrammatic form. So this was, if I may say so, was a very important stage for archaeology, and it took archaeology from a one-dimensional paradigm of the section, which is simply a look into the depth of a site, from that to four dimensions. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, it deals with the three physical dimensions of stratification in archaeological sites, plus time.
Okay.
So the difference between a Harris Matrix diagram and, say, one of Linus Pauling's models for chemical compounds and molecules is that he took biology or chemistry, whatever it was, from one dimension to three.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there's no time in his in his models or his sequences because there is no time in them. Whereas in ours, we have the element of time, which takes it to four dimensions.
Right. So what, your book on this, correct me if I'm wrong, was published in 1973?
No, the invention was in 73, the book was in 79.
Okay, so how long did it take people to, you know, really adopt this? Because it seems like, at least in England and other places, it's, I mean, it's the thing that you learn, you know, about archaeology initially and use.
Well, I have to say, as we have Sunzia with us, it, overseas it was the Italians who really first took to it. I don't know if you say like ducks to water, but and in fact, the Italian translation is now something like his 25th printing of the Italian edition. No, but it took quite a while, and in fact, it took about 5 years between the time of the invention and the publication of the book, which I happened, fortunately, to end up doing as my PhD thesis, to figure out what archaeologists weren't doing correctly on archaeological sites. So, you know, in the, this was the sort of early days of computers, if you will, and a lot of the early matrix diagrams were a question of garbage in and garbage out, because they were missing some key elements in the interpretation of stratification, without which you could not make your stratigraphic sequence stand up properly.
Right.
So it took about 5 years between that, and then the book was published 6 months after I finished my thesis.
Okay. So is this, I mean, you've already kind of explained it a little bit, but was this a just a complete departure from what was getting done beforehand, and you just you came in with this new idea, or was it really a modification of what people were doing before that?
I wouldn't say it was a modification, and I look upon it as a sort of a visual change and deviation. In other words, it was a almost a sort of artistic departure. It occurred because I was doodling one night. Well, just to back up a bit, the issue that was clearly coming to the fore, not only in England but in most other countries, where archaeologists were digging more stratigraphically, so they weren't just hauling things away. I mean, if you dig arbitrarily for your whole site, you end up with an arbitrary stratigraphic sequence. It's like a deck of cards. It's really no use to anyone. And in digging better stratigraphically, the stratigraphic information is just piling up. And so you could have some of these sites, say in London or whatever, or Rome or whatever, with thousands of stratigraphic units. So the problem is slowly coming to the fore as to how do you organize that information. And I had been digging for a while in Winchester, and I went to Norway for a year, and I came back and I went back to Winchester, and they said, well, right, your job is to sort it out. What does that mean? And they say, well, here's the Lower Brook Strait site that had been excavated for 6 years in the late 60s and ended in 71. There's 70 site notebooks, 250 plans, a number of sections and so on. Sort it out. Well, ultimately, you know what that meant was create the stratigraphic sequence.
Yeah.
Now, what you can do, and people listening, if they want to do it as an exercise, let's look back through any publications pre-1973 or 75 or whatever, and see how many times you can find a reference to the phrase stratigraphic sequence.
Yeah.
And it doesn't exist very much because we weren't looking for that. We really weren't looking for the time sequence. We were looking for the physical sequence and the evidence of that. And so, my train of thought. So I was given this problem, what people were doing at the time, the other people I were working with, is you'd start reading through the notebook and, you know, this feature or that layer is over this one, is over that one, and you had a form that you wrote it down on, and you wrote down all these relationships, and then you turn the page, and all you were doing, unfortunately, was translating the notebook into another notebook. The only difference was you were using individual pages. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting how a lot of these sort of things are a sort of a lock on one's imagination or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we should never have used notebooks, because notebooks, you can't shuffle them.
Right.
Whereas if you use individual sheets for individual units of stratification, you can shuffle them, which is what you eventually have to do. Because as you're digging, you're not finding things in absolutely the right order you want. They should be at the end of the dig, because things have to move around on the stratigraphic sequence. So when you put things into a notebook, you're locking the information in, and it's not allowing you to progress from that. So when we were trying to sort out what we now know as a stratigraphic sequence, we were simply going from one verbal or written form into another written form. And the problem with that is that when you turn the page, and when you turn a half a dozen pages, and you've got, you know, even six units of stratification with 30 different recorded relationships, your brain simply cannot process it.
Yeah.
And this is the pre-computer days and so on. So my view was I had to see where I was going. And so in order to do these forms, you ended up making these sort of incipient stratigraphic sequences that look like a mess of spaghetti, mm-hmm. you know, with the layers and features at the end of each strand and so forth. And so I started trying to straighten them up. And I was doing that one night, fiddling around, and I had a piece of gridded metric paper underneath a piece of tracing paper. I was trying to sort of tidy these things up. And I started doodling, and I made about, you know, 6-inch square of little rectangular boxes with spaces in between. And that was it. Boom.
Nice.
And I just knew that something had changed. So to go back to what I said earlier, I view it as a sort of artistic, you know, what's the epiphany on the road to Damascus or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew that I had the solution to the problem, but I just really didn't know how full the problem was or how large the problem was. And that's why it took about 5 years to figure out what on earth we were doing, so that we couldn't get these stratigraphic sequences to clarify. Mm-hmm. And part of the issue was that we had to eventually break away from the concept of a section in order to allow the sequences to stand up. So okay. When you look at an archaeological section, everything is compacted, it's all together. And one of the things I'm going to bring to San Francisco is one of these little toys, where you press the bottom of the toy and in this case, a little dinosaur collapses.
Hmm.
And that is...
Oh, those, I know what you're talking about.
That's the section, that's the state of stratification. And the point being is that when you have it, the material compacted as you find it, you have many physical relationships.
Yeah.
But when you release the spring on the bottom of the animal and it stands upright into its skeleton or sequence, a lot of the relationships are redundant.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of the major points we had to get away from. It's that in a time sequence, not all physical relationships are important ones. So one of the things that I did early on, it was the second thing I think I published on it, was I said, well, we have to have our own laws. That's the other thing as well. We had to get rid of geology, which caused a lot of problems. There were a lot of geoarchaeologists in particular who didn't like me. Well, like the idea, let's say that. They didn't know me, so it didn't matter. But they didn't like the idea. And what we basically said was that archaeological stratification and stratigraphy is of an entirely different nature in terms of content from geology. And that in order to understand our type of stratification, we needed our own laws. We needed our own procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why the book was called Principles of Archaeological Stratigraphy, whereas you can buy dozens of books called Principles of Geological Stratigraphy or Principles of Stratigraphy. And so that's what I started gearing towards. And we rewrote some of the fundamental laws, like the law of superposition and so forth. But we also added in a law called the law of stratigraphical succession, which if you don't apply it, you can't get your sequence to stand up properly and to work properly. And finally, of course, at the end of the day, the stratigraphic sequence of an archaeological site, which is only expressible in a Harris matrix diagram, becomes the testing pattern for all later analysis of the site, no matter what. Mm-hmm. So it comes back to the statement made by a great British geologist, Sir Charles Lyell, where he says that the stratification of the Earth is undesignedly commemorative of the past. And what he meant by that was that nobody goes out to make stratification. It's a byproduct of living.
Yeah.
And therefore, as an archaeologist, if you can undecipher the site, dig it properly stratigraphically, you have captured an unbiased sequence of the events of the past on that site. And anybody can do that. And of course, the importance of the principles of archaeological stratigraphy in the Harris matrix is that you can apply them to any site anywhere in the world. It's not a question you can apply them, you should apply them. If you're not doing it, you're basically digging a hole into oblivion for the history of that site, generally speaking. And the reason for that is that stratification is everywhere the same. It's composed of two basic units, deposits and surfaces. And of course, it's the surfaces which we were missing. And part of that was because of the nature of how archaeologists saw themselves. Just like the notebook blocks up data and you can't manipulate it, we don't have that problem now, of course, with digital recording. You can press the button and shuffle. And but we got locked into the concept that you were diggers. And of course, when you dig, you're digging the deposits. And surfaces don't exist. You can destroy them. They don't exist. They're like time. They don't exist unless you record them.
Right.
If you don't record a surface, you cannot reconstruct the site. And in fact, you cannot clarify your stratigraphic sequence. And this has been one of the great omissions in archaeology. So that we can say probably categorically that prior to laying everything out in the late 70s with the Harris matrix and the associated concepts, some of which are just as important as the matrix, that most archaeologists under-recorded their sites by at least 50%, probably more. And part of the issue about the surfaces, of course, is that there are always more surfaces on archaeological sites than there are deposits.
Right.
And if you're going to, and you can try this if you want to, you know, in some of your interviews with people, ask them what is the purpose of doing an excavation? What's one of the products of doing that? What do you as an archaeologist think you're supposed to be doing? Or, you know, what if you do nothing else, what is the most fundamental thing that you should do after you be able to do after your dig? And that, of course, is the reconstruction of the site.
Mm-hmm.
And when you reconstruct the site, you actually don't care one iota in the first instance as to what's in the deposits. And in fact, you can dig an archaeological site that doesn't have one iota of artifact on it, and you can still recover your stratigraphic sequence and reconstruct the site. So it's like when you put Humpty Dumpty back together again, if you haven't recorded the surface or the plates of the surface before he cracked up or whatever, you can't put him back together again. And when you put him back together again, it doesn't matter what was inside the yolk and the white. It just doesn't matter. What you're doing is recreating the surfaces, because people live on surfaces. They don't live in deposits. And that's a whole other major philosophical question as well, because what one can begin to suggest is that contrary to the current way that people might look at deposits, you can almost begin to suggest that every deposit contains an archaeological story, but it's actually not about the site necessarily itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's about something else, because it's been sucked in from somewhere else, even if it was only 6 foot away, and then put into disuse.
Right.
So deposits are periods of disuse, and people live on top of them. They build a wall, and they live on with the surface of the walls and so forth. And so there are major issues to do with surfaces and archaeology. And the younger generations now are in a much better state of play because, of course, we have GIS and GPS and digital mapping and all this sort of thing associated with that, which didn't exist before, which is why most surfaces weren't recorded because, first off, a lot of them weren't sort of diagnostically important.
Mm-hmm.
So you dig and dig until you find something you thought was important, say a mosaic floor or,
yeah,
or whatever, something that looked good or whatever. And so you'd stop the dig and you'd record that. But other than that, they did not consider most surfaces to be of importance in terms of recording.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just destroyed them when you started digging the deposit. The other thing that goes along with that, of course, is if you don't define the surface before you dig the deposit or whatever is underneath of it, because, of course, there are many surfaces which have no deposits.
Mm-hmm.
So if we dig an electricity trench through this room here, you're creating a surface that has no deposits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a standalone surface. But once you dig through the surface, then if you have any problems with the artifacts in it, just say you spot recorded every artifact and so forth, but you didn't define the limits of the surface, you've got very little way of checking back by overlaying things to see where the problem could have come in from above or whatever. So there's all the interesting things like that. But at the end of the day, the fundamental thing about not recording surfaces is you cannot reconstruct the site. And this ties back, of course, to the evolution of the whole business. I mean, we've started off as, all of us started off as pot hunters, as it were. You just destroyed the site to get some artifacts. And then people became interested in architectural remains, so they destroyed the stratification in order to get to the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And, I saw a recent example of this some years ago in an American city where we, looked at various things, and all the records, walls are very well recorded, but all the connections between them, the stratification and surfaces, had not been. So there's absolutely nothing you do. These things are floating,
yeah,
unstratified in the record.
Right.
And so surfaces, along with the matrix, are really two of the key elements of stratification.
Okay, well, let's take a break real quick, and we'll come back with some questions based on all we just learned.
At digitaltraining.site, we believe that spending money on learning is great if it helps you solve a problem. If you're a cultural resource management professional, you want to make your workflow faster and more efficient to beat your competitors. If you're a student or young professional, you'll want to learn marketable skills to get that job. If you're a faculty, you want to stay up to date with teaching topics, but you feel overwhelmed by all the technologies and tools out there. Digitaltraining.site is for you. You'll get relevant topics by top-level instructors and downloadable materials at an affordable cost. And if you're an enrolled student, apply for a scholarship and attend for free. Start learning now at digitaltraining.site.
Okay, we're back, and just so people understand what's going on here, we're right next to them setting up for the CRM Expo for the last afternoon of the conference, so there's probably going to be some more noise, and there's occasional seaplanes taking off overhead because we basically have a tent over us and we can hear everything happening outside, so just wanted to preface that if there's some noisy things we can't get rid of. But that being said, so that was a great introduction into the Harris Matrix, how it's used, and what it's all about. Cinzia, you're here. You're from Italy. You've used the Harris Matrix. You were, raised archaeologically on the Harris Matrix, probably. So why don't you give us your feedback and your input on the first part,
yes,
of the discussion?
Yes, absolutely. I was just saying during the break that I'm here excitedly nodding at every word that Professor Harris is saying, because not only I'm a big fan of him and his work, but as a European archaeologist, I have been using the Harris Matrix as a standard operational tool in all of my projects. I've been in Africa for my first project. in Sudan in 1989, and the Harris Matrix was already a total standard in that project, but in many of our colleagues' projects at the time. And then in Egypt, in Ethiopia, and I have participated in some excavation projects in Italy. And I wanted to add that. Yes, I want to say that Professor Harris said that it was an important step inventing the Harris Matrix, and I loved the story. I didn't know it. The very precise moment when he came up with the idea of the little boxes, and that was it. And that was really it. So it was an important step. Saying that it was an important step is understating it. It was a total revolution in archaeological theory as well as in the excavation practice. And I also wanted to add that using the Harris method provides the only way to connect the different areas. So when you are working on very large and very large sites with complex stratigraphies, very rarely you can work on the sites for hundreds of years excavating completely the site. You have to sample areas, you have to open different trenches, and making sense of those sequences in different locations on the same site is an extremely complex job. So the Harris Matrix provides that perfect tool that allows you to connect, to find the links in the various stratigraphies that you create on a site.
That's a good point. I'll interject real quick, because I work in the United States, and I've done excavations on the East Coast and on the West Coast and in the middle, and you know, obviously was educated in the United States, and the Harris Matrix is something that I just heard about, but it wasn't actually taught in school as a thing that we should do. And in a lot of CRM projects, which quite frankly you've got a bulldozer hanging over your head, so it really is almost pot hunting in a lot of cases. It's just like, let's get down and pull the things out, and unfortunately that's the reality. However, I've gone on to projects before that are continuing a phase of previous excavation, and I honestly don't know how the project managers organize the whole thing, continuing somebody else's work without having that sort of foundation from the previous work.
Well, one of the important things about the Matrix from that administrative point of view, of course, is that you can do that. Because you can, even before the days of computer, you could build your sequence as you go. Generally speaking, we excavate by hand, so you can only excavate so much every day. Mm-hmm. And even if you have 100 people working on the site, you might complete 100 units of excavation or 100 units of recording, whatever, during the day. And at the end of the day, each of the units, in effect, floats up into its position on the stratigraphic sequence. So you've been digging for a month or so and so forth, and you get a whole raft of new volunteers, and you waltz them into the site hut and say, look, this is where we are. We're going backwards in time, so we're starting up here at the top, and you know, there's a volcanic ash fall that covered the whole site, so that's the big blanket one at the top. And then we work down, and then we come to a building. Once you come to a building, the sequence bifurcates and becomes multilinear, because things happening in the room are not what's happening on the outside.
Right.
And then you get to the point of saying, now, you are starting to you're going to be excavating underneath this line, this column here. That's where you are. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that, you know, you're in the 12th century, and that's where you're going to be working. Mm-hmm. And your job is to make sure you record this properly, and at the end of the day, to make sure that your units get into the sequence where they belong. The whole point of doing the Harris Matrix while you dig is that you can walk off the site with it finished the day you finish your last digging. And you don't have to do as I did for almost 2 years, trying to figure out this stratigraphic sequence on this site. Now, on this particular site, I ended up with about 10,000 stratigraphic units from the notebooks. But of course, as I say, they did record certain surfaces, which they called features, pits and things like that. So they're beginning to acknowledge that, in fact, there were certain stratigraphic units that didn't have any deposits and had value. So they're called features. But still, that particular site was not only under-recorded by 40% or whatever or more, because a lot of the surfaces weren't recorded, but because there was no matrix to force you to keep things in order as you dug, a lot of the information was unstratified, because you forgot to record go back for the previous day and say, well, that was actually on top of this, mm-hmm. now that we found that, and so forth. And so a lot of the things in the middle of the site where you know you dug above them and you dug straight through them and you dug down below, but in the sequence, they're hanging. There's either nothing below them or nothing on top of them.
Right.
And of course, what that happens, they can drop through either end, so you can't control them. A part of the point of the sequence is that, you know, on any particular line with a group of stratigraphic units, there are limits imposed to the movement of those features by the stratigraphic sequence. And if you don't record them and things become unstratified in the record, you muck the whole thing up as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so administratively, you talk about CRM, but CRM is no excuse for not using the matrix. In fact, if you use the matrix, you could actually dig faster, more coherently, and come up with a good job at the end of it. Now that brings us on to cultural matters in a way. My view is that part of the issues in this great country, of which I'm a part citizen, I carry a blue passport, and including other red ones and so forth, until these idiots went Brexiting, but anyway, it's a cultural thing.
Yeah.
And to a degree in this country, and again, I'm talking generally, I haven't sat down to really sort of organize this, and
mm-hmm.
nobody's given me a bunch of grant money so I can go all over the country looking at people's records, if they'll show them to you.
Right.
But a lot of the work started off in the United States to a degree on prehistoric sites.
Mm-hmm.
And prehistorians, for some reason, not only in America but in other places, seem to claim that because it's a prehistoric site, it's really not stratified, which we know is untrue. And we increasingly know it's untrue. Every archaeological site is stratified, even if it only has one deposit. If it has one deposit, it's going to have two surfaces. The surface of the deposit and the surface that the deposit's sitting on. So already you've got, you know, you're stratified. It's,
mm-hmm.
All archaeological sites are stratified, even if they're scatter things. You still have stratigraphic relationships, which is something sitting on top of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, whenever you're doing all of this sort of stuff, it's so simple, and people shouldn't get bent out of shape about it, because all you're ever asking of any two particular units is, which came first in relative time? That's your job. Of course, a lot of that can't be sorted out if you don't follow the surfaces. So, for example, just to sort of deviate, in London, you could be digging down and you get through the Roman town, London, and so forth. You might even get some prehistoric stuff. And then let's just say you kept on going, you got into the London clays, which are clearly geological. And then halfway through the, you know, 10 meters of London clay, well, this is a bloody hole with a tube train running through it. Well, you know, in the classic rules, that tube train is earlier than the London clays and everything else. Until you follow the surface. And you follow the surface to the latest point at which it cuts through the stratification,
mm-hmm.
which of course will take you back up the road, up the hill, and out into Victoria Station in the fresh air.
Right.
And so this is the part of the importance of surfaces. But there is absolutely no excuse for not using the matrix, and every excuse for using it, because it helps you to administer the site, it helps you to make the site come alive while you're digging it. If you've got visitors coming to the site, donors to the dig or something like that, they can all understand. You say, well, let's just follow this trail here. This takes us down through here, through the room of that house, underneath of it, and down in it, blah, 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 and so forth. And all of a sudden, they all connect again because the site was flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And then we dug that away, and off you go underneath of it. And it just is the unifying force for the whole exercise. And anyone who doesn't use the matrix, or let me put it this way, anybody who doesn't record stratigraphically by stratigraphic principles and construct a stratigraphic sequence, which is really what the matrix was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the profession in a way sort of did me a nice compliment by always calling these things Harris matrices or whatever. But they're stratigraphic sequences. The matrix was just, I named it that evening as a joke. I mean, it was even, what do I know about matrices
what
or mathematics?
Joke.
And So, but they're stratigraphic sequences. But you know, even there, you see, it took a while to call it a stratigraphic sequence. And in fact, my original matrix, the original matrix drawings lost, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what happened to it. I've got copies of it, but it's lost.
Yeah.
And but it was called a layer chart.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, we were digging deposits and the importance of the surface didn't come into it. So, of course, once you realize surfaces are important, you can't call it a layer chart because layer and surface is chart. And then finally, the sort of penny dropped that what we're looking at is the stratigraphic sequence, which is the diagrammatic form to show you the sequence through your site in relative time.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, you move on to that from to get into the questions of absolute time. And this is where your artifacts kick in. But again, just to come back to it, you can successfully excavate a site and not find one artifact. Now, of course, by that I mean the sort of things that people made. Now, any site is going to contain some sort of artifact information, be it Equifax or whatever. It's always going to contain something in the deposits. The question is then, what is the value of that material in the first instance in relationship to your stratigraphic sequence to date the sequence or the deposit in absolute time?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the fun begins, because of course your deposits start to move in relationship to an absolute scale on the side of your sequence. So, for example, you could have a sequence that eventually sort of stretches from modern times down into Roman times, and there might be a huge gap in the middle because there was no occupation.
Mm.
So you got a lot of cluster at the top and a lot of stuff at the bottom. What the stratigraphic sequence, the matrix, also does is really begin to allow you to see what the nature of the site is in general evolutionary terms.
Right.
So, for example, the site I worked in, which caused the creation of the matrix, when I finished the diagram, if you looked at it from the early times, you had Roman, so there was quite a bit of activity in the Roman period, and then you had the Saxon period of Dark Ages, where literally the site shrank, stratigraphically speaking, and the evidence for it was there stratigraphically. And then you had the sort of medieval and post-medieval period where people were building houses on the site, and all of a sudden, boom, you've got this huge explosion of stratigraphic data. So you can look at this site and see what it's doing. Or you can even look at a lot of diagrams. I mean, people can show me a diagram and say, what is this? I say, well, that's no question. That's probably a graveyard. Because it's a long, spread-out thing with a lot of surfaces with deposits on individual strands and so forth. So each grave in a graveyard, for example, is a site unto itself. And as Zinzia was saying, in order to compare those, you need to have your matrix diagram. So with a graveyard, you can almost say it's like a very long abacus instrument, and these little things can move up or down, but they're locked by whatever's happening at the top of the bottom. They can't go all the way, okay, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so it provides so many different aspects to do with the administration, the proper recording and control of the recording, and make sure you've done it right. But what happened is that it simplified the recording. Of course, a lot of people didn't like it. A lot of the directors didn't like it. You see, because the part of the mystique of archaeology is, was, you know, developed by archaeologists who thought they were be-all and the end-all of a particular site. It's my site.
Right.
It's my site, my records, and so forth. I'm the director. The director knows best, you know, like Daddy
my
knows
research.
Best. Yes, my research. Blah, blah, blah. And so you had this sort of qualitative thing introduced into it, undemocratic, if you will. And I remember one day I was sitting on my veranda and in Bermuda, and an archaeologist friend of mine visited from England I hadn't seen for some time, and we were chatting about sort of things, and we got into some sort of political discussion, and I didn't say I was a Trump supporter or something like that, but I probably made some conservative comment, and he was aghast because he saw the Matrix as the democratization. What's the word?
Democratization?
Yes.
Yes.
Of an archaeological site. In other words, the control was taken away from the emperor, the director, and put where it belongs, in the hand of the actual digger.
Yeah.
And I say this often to people, on students, particularly on a dig. You are the most important person. You are the one that does the discovery. You
Absolutely.
Are at the interface between today and saving the past, and recording the past and so on. You are the one. So the most important people on the dig are the diggers. And they're the ones that should have the tools to make sure they do their job properly. And the easiest way to do that, and the best way, and really the only way, is to use the methods associated with the Harris Matrix. And you can teach people how to do that in a matter of 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just monitor to make sure they've done it right, and they're monitoring to make sure their stuff gets up into the sequence and so forth. So when we, shortly after the Matrix was invented, I was looking around to find somebody who was willing to give it a try.
Yeah.
And at the time, I couldn't do anything where I was. Because of opposition. So I went to London, and Brian Hobley was then the director of the Urban Archaeology Unit, or whatever it's called, and they were digging a very big site on the site of the old General Post Office up at St. Paul's. And I said, would you try this? And to my amazement, he and his site supervisors and people said, yeah, we'll give it a try. And so I went up several times after that, the apostle or whatever, spending my own money preaching the gospel. And so we went up several times to have sort of, discussions and training sessions and so on. And after about 3 months, basically the word came in that this improved everything. It made the excavation recording faster than by, yards or whatever. And was clearly the only way to go. And from there, they went on and on. They eventually produced their little red book, manual on digging, or whatever it's called. It went on from there. But they showed that everything that one had in the back of your mind or you thought could happen, did happen. And so from there, we started to spread the word. And there were several occasions where fights broke out in the lecture halls and so on, because not only were you attacking the way things were being done and the preeminence of the director, but you were undermining the image of archaeology, the paradigms of archaeology, there you ended up having those who supported the old guard and those who supported the revolution. I remember one time I was in Australia for a year, and decided to give a talk and a lecture. This was in 77, so it was still young. And they drink a lot in Australia. So I decided that, just going to listen to all this rubbish, we should have a drink. So I went out and bought a couple cases of good Australian wine, and we started drinking before the talk.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the talk, quite a few people were not in the best of form, and they really started going at it and fighting, so we had to pour more wine about the place and so on. But there's been, in a number of quarters, there have been severe objections to this for unreasonable grounds, and for a failure of the people who objected to it to understand really what it was all about.
Yeah.
And that, say, in the case of geoarchaeologists, we were not going against geological principles. We were simply saying that geological principles have not been designed for archaeological sites, and they're inadequate for the terribly complex stratification of archaeological sites.
Mm-hmm.
Geologists, don't deal, generally speaking, in a limited space with the complexity, that is to say, the numerous amount of units and layers of stratification that archaeologists have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them would be scratching their heads if you took them out to a dig and said, please sort this dig out. They deal in much larger terms. We had to end up doing our own thing, which is where we pushed it all. And so it went on from there.
Okay.
And slowly spread around the world. I think it's in 8 foreign languages now, a couple more to come. But it's very interesting, that book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Oh, yeah. Kuhn.
Yeah, and you wouldn't believe it, but this is an example of where it literally has taken a generation or more to for the revolution to come into full effect. These people, literally, a lot of these people have got to drop dead before we can get change because they won't accept it. And of course, part of the problem is that, in many instances, you can't really accept it unless you're willing to accept the fact that you're guilty.
Yes.
That you didn't do the job as it should have been done. But on the other hand, a lot of people appreciate that's the way we did it then. It's time to change. And, let's see what we can squeeze out of the work that I did 40 years ago, appreciating that, we didn't have the tools. We have the tools now. We should have no excuses. But again, this comes back to something you talked about earlier, taught ethics and standards and archaeology and so on. For this organization, perhaps, or other organizations I've looked at, they have pages and pages to do with the ethics of, say, dealing with native peoples or whatever. But there's no or very little information about the ethics of doing your job as an archaeologist properly and stratigraphically. There's no standard, and a lot of people don't want to accept the standard, because they'll be guilty.
Right.
And the other problem, of course, is that, particularly in this country, the money is controlled by the anthropologists. And the fact of the matter is that they're two entirely different disciplines when it comes to collecting the raw data.
Mm-hmm.
So, generally speaking, anthropologists, in the classic sort of way, would go out to a group of primitive people, or however you want to call them, to study them, or even nowadays you might go into a factory to sort out how they organize themselves or whatever. When you're collecting primary data for archaeology, you're going and digging things up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're two entirely different things. Mm-hmm. And in my view, unfortunately, generations of archaeologists, people who want to be archaeologists in America, and again we're talking about a cultural thing, have been forced to become anthropologists as well and to apply all sorts of anthropological theories to archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but that should be later.
Yeah.
In other words, people who want to be archaeologists should be first-class stratigraphers, first-class excavators, creating the new bodies of data. Once you have the new bodies of data, everybody can chew it over, the anthropologists, historians, whoever wants to chew it over.
Yeah.
The carbon 14 people, whatever. There's no end of people who would wish to look at the raw data created by an archaeologist. And again, this is where the matrix comes in as well, because if I was doing a dig now, let's just say for some reason I had a lot of C14 samples.
It's noon in Vancouver, by the way.
Oh, right.
It's been every day.
Is that right?
Yes.
Good. We used to have a fire engine, a fire alarm thing in Bermuda for noon, noon day. But let's say I've collected tons of carbon-14 samples from my site, and I send them out to a laboratory to get them tested or whatever you do with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I should be sending along with them is the stratigraphic sequence showing where every sample came from.
Yeah.
So that you're asking the laboratory people to give their views on the date of the carbon-14 dates.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you're asking them to be thinking about it at the time as to whether those dates seem to work in terms of the position of the sample in the stratigraphic sequence, and that's seldom done. Same thing with coins and so forth. I mean, one of the early examples of that came from a chap called Richard Rees, who was working with, I think it's Henry Hurst. They worked with the Italians at Carthage, and Richard, the coin person, And so he put together, they put together a stratigraphic sequence, and then he fed in all the coins.
Yeah.
Now, in the old days, the director would come around and they'd look at the trays for each deposit, and the director would tell you what he thought. But they were never looked at in terms of their position in the stratigraphic sequence, because they didn't know where that was.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't made a stratigraphic sequence. So, this is, 100 AD or whatever, Caesar, the great Caesar, whatever. But what they found at Carthage when they did this experiment is that most of the coins were useless from a dating point of view because they weren't contemporaneous with the deposit when compared up and down the scale of the stratigraphic sequence with the other deposits. And this is the whole point of the thing, is that artifacts are not to be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
They are the criminals in the whole lot. You are not to be trusted artifact. If you've done your stratification, your dig right, and so forth, you've created your stratigraphic sequence, that can be trusted.
Okay.
Again, it's undesignedly commemorative of the past. It's unbiased, unless you're just a bad excavator.
Right.
And you know. But if you're a bad excavator, you're going to have trouble creating a stratigraphic sequence because it's going to get jumbled up.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, artifacts are not to be trusted, and the only way to control artifacts, to test them, and to squeeze out of them their full value, not only from a first chronological point of view, but in every other sense, is to test them against the stratigraphic sequence. And by and large, this is probably not done. Well, if you don't have a stratigraphic sequence in the first place, you can't do it, but even moving on from there, it starts to be a difficult proposition. So a colleague of mine called David Bibby, I don't remember how this happened. David came a bit later. But anyway, one day this chap from Scotland wrote a little paper that I was asked to comment on where he began to realize the major issues when you looked at a stratigraphic sequence, if the stratigraphic sequence had any number of strands.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a deck of cards. It was several decks of cards. And how did you compare the one to the other? Which on any site is no different comparing one site to another. So when you get a house, for example, you have a house of seven rooms, you know you're going to have seven strands inside the house, and you're going to have strands outside of the house. So it's like having different sites and so on. So the question is, where eventually do the deposits and the surfaces they push up and down end up coming out? And that, of course, to a degree is helped by the artifacts. Now, there are certain things that, for example, that if you're dealing with something like a house and so on, you can push things based upon their architectural connections.
Yeah.
So, this wall, whatever, move it around. But when it comes to dealing with the artifacts, the matrix is the testing pattern that allows the artifacts to really come to the fore and give their full force of value to the site, but controlled.
Right.
And without that, you're really just whistling in the wind. You can look at a group of group of artifacts from a deposit, and you pick out the most obvious thing and say, well, this is a coin, therefore this deposit was put down around this sort of date. But maybe within that you've got pottery, which is earlier than the coin, and it's earlier than the coin from other sort of things, so on. So then you get into the question of the analysis of multilinear stratigraphic sequences, and this is what this chap wrote this paper for a Scottish Archaeological Review, I think it was called, started realizing. I got one morning and said, oh my God, what are we going to do? I mean, this is going to get messy. It's going to get very complex. And I wrote a response to it, but later on, a chap called David Bibby, and David started looking at a lot of this more systematically, seeing if you could construct a mathematical formula that would allow you to say, well, the sequences, the different lines of sequence can only move so far and so forth and so on. But it's a whole area which has not been touched that very much in archaeology. because it's one of the great problem childs.
Yeah.
But of course, now with the with the computers, you've got the technical machinery, so you can do a lot of this stuff fast and quickly and so on. So it is a bit of a major problem. But then just to you run that forward, at the end of the day, you've looked at all your, analyzed all your artifacts, you managed to squeeze some absolute time dates out of them which seem to be correct and so forth. And so your site then becomes rearranged within the stratigraphic sequence to what it should be at absolute time, not according to the time in which you dug it. That is to say, in some areas of the site you might dig faster than others and so forth and so on. So you're recording things at different periods and so on. It's only after the analysis of the artifacts, if you have some, you can then say, well, all of these belong here, and therefore this is a period on the site or a phase on the site where things change. But even these things are, as I say, a bit complicated, because you're talking about phases of deposition and disuse versus phases of surfaces and use.
Yeah.
So this Phyllis.
Women in Archaeology is a show about archaeology by the Women of Archaeology. An alternating panel of women archaeologists discuss the issues in archaeology that impact professionals and the public every day. Check out Women in Archaeology for a different perspective on the past today at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/WIA. Now let's get back to the show.
I just wanted to chime in modestly. My practice, I was listening a lot, and I have in my practice, I have levels of reliability for things, going back to artifacts. So assuming, of course, that I have been doing a good job in creating my matrix day by day, feature by feature, the matrix, the stratigraphic sequence comes first in terms of reliability. These are the groups of things and how they connect to each other. Then pottery. I am a pottery specialist, and because pottery is one of the largest and most common finds on excavation, of course you can have some level of mix up in the materials, but if you have a consistency through strata of pottery, that is definitely one big diagnostic element for us. And then they become the smaller finds, then the coins, and at the very end, for me, the C14, or the absolute dating. And so everything for me locks in. The way I look at things is how all these other elements lock in onto the matrix, onto the stratigraphic unit, the stratigraphic sequence, sorry. So that is, I was just confirming and very much agreeing with Professor Harris' statements.
Well, we are just about out of time, but I do have a couple extra questions here. First off, I will say the Harris matrix rolls off the tongue better than the Harris stratigraphic sequence. So, I'm glad that's the thing. And also the whole scientific revolution thing that you were mentioning earlier, and how it takes some people a generation. I mean, we're definitely finding that out with the paperless archaeology push. You really have to kind of let people just take their paper to the grave with them, and then we replace it with, the newer thing. So I fully understand what you're saying there. But just in the last few minutes here, as you've gone along since the publication of the book and it keeps getting reprinted in places. You mentioned in Italy, it's in the 20 some odd, printing. Have there been any major revisions or anything planned or anything else proposed by anyone as an addition to the Harris Matrix, or is it really the same as when you publish the book, and it's still working just as well?
Well, let me just say to begin with that anybody who doesn't like these ideas or whatever has to sit back and realize that we are surrounded by stratigraphic entities in our lives.
Yeah.
If you're a motorcycle fanatic or something like that, and you take a motorbike apart, you're doing a stratigraphic exercise. You're taking it apart to the reverse order into which it was put together.
Yeah.
And of course, if you don't keep track of where the nuts and bolts and washers go, you can't put it back together again properly. So, you know, you've got to create a sequence, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So stratification is very, very important. And I often say to people, if you can see the world stratigraphically, it totally changes the way you look at the world.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of the matrix itself, the fact of the matter is that from the time, given that it took 5 years to really sort the system out, but from the time it was invented, it was a true system. And by that I mean that for whatever reasons, as it was born, it was correct and right. And so that's when you took archaeological data and put it in, it was garbage in and garbage out, until we understood that the system was true, it was the information you were feeding into it that was incorrect.
Yeah.
So there's really been no improvement, if you want to say it that way, or suggested changes or whatever, because they're not necessary. The changes that have taken place are where the technology is allowing us to record much faster.
Mm-hmm.
So 3D laser scanning, for example, on an archaeological site, instead of recording surfaces by hand, is a major technological advance.
Yeah.
But they're still doing what we used to do by hand, which is to record the surfaces. So the fact of the matter is that after almost 50 years, it's still going strong. Now, what we did, it was published by Academic Press, and the book was very small, very expensive. It was always very expensive. So I guess it was about 7 years ago, I bought out the publisher, and my friends in the University of Vienna, Dr. Wolfgang Neubauer, Klaus Locker, made up a website, and we put it on the website for free downloading.
Hmm.
And we just asked if people would make a comment, if they would, and so forth, before they downloaded it. So it's now on there in six languages,
yeah.
Because as, say, for example, the Spanish edition, they didn't want to print it anymore because they weren't making any money on it.
Yeah.
So we got the rights to it, and we stuck it up on the internet for free downloading.
And help me, the link is
harrismatrix.com.
.com. Yes.
We'll have that in the show notes.
Yes.
And we're going to continue with that, but the point is that it's interesting enough, a lot of scientific inventions, you know, don't survive that long because things do advance. But the things that we were talking about, the principles of archaeological stratigraphy, are so fundamental, they're like a periodic chart.
Yeah.
And it's not going to change.
Gotcha.
So it's a simple business. Everybody should do it. They'd feel better about all their work if they did do it. They'd sleep better at night. And they would recover the archaeological site instead of digging it into oblivion. So that's the mantra. That's still the crusade after 45 years or whatever it is. But it's been very enjoyable, and it's been very kind of the profession to continue to call it Harris Matrix.
Awesome. Well, we'll end this with Cinzia. We've got a pretty exciting thing at CODA coming up in April. I guess now is April, so this month.
Yes.
So why don't you go ahead and tell everybody about what that is.
Yeah, just reminding of this fantastic opportunity we have with Professor Harris. He will be teaching a webinar for our CODA training program. And of course, it will be about stratification of time and the Harris Matrix. And it will be on Tuesday, April 18th, 9:30 a.m. PST. So join us. This is really a unique opportunity. Well, I hope it will be just the start, you know, the beginning of hopefully a collaboration of some sort. And I want to just throw an idea here. There have been a number of software attempts to represent and reconstruct the Harris Matrix. I am frankly not super happy with any of those. I would love to launch the idea to our partners at Codify Inc. to work with Professor Harris to possibly explore ways in which we could better represent the Harris Matrix and build it into a database system that it
excellent
replicates yeah easily the work that the job that the Harris Matrix does on paper.
Right. And Cinzia seems like a pretty important person here, so listen to her about this webinar, because she's sitting here talking to Dr. Harris and was just delivered coffee and chocolate by Ruth Tringham.
I know, right?
So, you know.
I feel they shouldn't be with me. I am totally passing coffee and chocolate and everything to Professor Harris, together with my soul.
So check that out. We'll have links in the show notes. We'll have links to digitaltraining.site where you can find that webinar. And all about the Harris Matrix, and download the book in several different languages, and learn about it. And again, if you want more information, check out the webinar from CODA, and Dr. Harris will be telling you all more about it and in much more detail than we covered
here.
Yeah,
we're looking
on
this podcast.
And just
looking
to say, downloading
to
for free.
For free.
Yes, download
yes.
it for
Spread
free.
The revolution.
Download it and learn it.
That's
learn
right.
it, learn it, learn
thank
it.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Cinzia.
Thank you. Thank you, Edward. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. This show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Go check it out. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.